From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Even as the number of new coronavirus cases and deaths continues to grow, President Trump said today that the White House Coronavirus Task Force will shift its mission and turn its focus to safety and reopening the country.
And Jeremy, across the Atlantic in the UK, Britain now has the highest coronavirus death toll in Europe, more than 32,000 deaths. And with that as a backdrop, Prime Minister Boris Johnson, himself still recovering from COVID-19, faced opposition leader Keir Starmer in the House of Commons for the first time. Here's Johnson.
I believe that, of course, there will be a time to look at what decisions we took and whether we could have taken different decisions. But I have absolutely no doubt that what the people of this country want us to do now is, as I said just now, to suppress this disease, to keep suppressing this disease, and to begin the work of getting our country's economy back on its feet. And I look forward to working with him and colleagues around the House to do just that.
NPR's London correspondent Frank Langford is here. And Frank, we hear Prime Minister Johnson saying time to look ahead. But Keir Starmer criticized Johnson's government for being slow to implement a lockdown, slow to ramp up testing, slow to provide personal protective gear to healthcare workers. Do Brits see this as a legitimate criticism?
Absolutely. The government, you know, ordered a lockdown back on March 23rd. This was even after many people here were self-isolating. British Medical Association said 48% of its doctors had to buy or protective gear or rely on donations. The one genuine success we've had here is the National Health Service hasn't collapsed, but otherwise it's not a good record.
Well, yes, and that when you make your bar, the fact that the whole system hasn't collapsed, you know. And so what is Johnson saying in response? This is a pugilist.
Yeah, he's actually agreed on some points and was deflecting on others. He said the lack of personal protective equipment was enraging. And on the death toll, he's claiming that there's just not enough data to say the UK has surpassed Europe. And what was really interesting to me, Robin, is, you know, Johnson is a populist. He doesn't really focus that much on detail and policy. And what was interesting was to watch Starmer. He's the new Labour leader, a former prosecutor. He was very forensic in the way that he approached Johnson. Johnson wasn't able to play to the crowd in the House of Commons because it's mostly empty. And I think showed some of the limits of Johnson's political approach, particularly in a crisis like this.
Well, in fact, you spoke to, the average citizen there. What are they thinking?
I think most people here don't think it's a very good record. A recent poll showed nearly 60% feel the government had failed them in not acting sooner. And this is a woman named Rochelle Lawson who delivers packages in London. This is what she said this morning.
We just took too long in our lockdown, and we haven't really taken our lockdown as serious as they have. I mean, I've got family that live in Spain and they've literally not been able to leave the house at all, which I personally wouldn't have liked, but I feel that that has made a big difference on the impact of the death toll.
So there's the view from one citizen. Meanwhile, we just want to ask you quickly while we have you about epidemiologist Neil Ferguson, also suffered COVID-19 and was the key government advisor on the coronavirus response. His models, the Imperial College models of the disease, were what spurred the lockdown finally on March 23rd. And he's now quit because he said he violated the restrictions that he advocated for. I think he went and saw a girlfriend. That's got to be reverberating.
Yeah, it was on the front pages of the papers today. Basically, his excuse was, his explanation was he thought he was immune because he already had it, but he felt that he had to resign because it seemed hypocritical, I guess, to a lot of people here. But some people also wonder if the timing of the story, since this did happen some time ago, was actually designed to distract from the death toll, which so dominated the news last night.
That's NPR's Frank Langfitt from London. Frank, thanks as always.
You're very welcome, Robin.
Well, here in this country, nearly two dozen states have ended their stay-at-home orders and restarted some industries. Only a handful of those are led by Democratic governors, among them Colorado, which took steps to reopen some offices and businesses this week. Joining us now is Colorado Governor Jared Polis. Governor, welcome.
Honored to join you.
When you told NPR a few weeks ago that you wanted to see a very clear downward trajectory for a while before reopening, federal guidelines suggest 14 days with fewer new cases each day, but your state's own data don't show that clear downward trajectory in the weeks leading up to Monday when you moved into this phase that you're in of reopening. What was in the data that made you decide this week was the time?
Well, it does show a very clear downward trend. We've been about 3 weeks. You can see our data at covid19.colorado.gov. We have now a positivity rate of about 10%, down from about 25% during the height of this. Our hospitalization rate is down by about a third from the height. Now, we're doing a lot more testing, right? So we're catching more cases, but that doesn't mean there are more cases. We're basing our actions on how many cases there are. And thankfully, with more testing, we're able to catch a higher percentage of those.
Well, you say you're doing more testing, but according to data collected by Vox, Colorado ranks in the bottom quarter of states for testing.
Well, we're certainly a smaller state, but we've increased testing by about 10 times from when this started, which was only a month and a half ago. We now have the capacity to process about 10,000 state tests each day in state, and we're conducting in the 2,000 to 4,000 range right now. We should be at about 5,000 a day very soon.
5,000 a day. Now, last week, you told Colorado Public Radio that you hid a shipment of tests from the federal government out of fear it would be seized. Are you able to get the tests you need?
Well, and that's part of the reason we're able to increase. We were able to acquire 100,000 tests from South Korea. Those have been deployed to our county healths. We have 20 different free community testing sites across our state. That's in addition to the hospitals that, of course, are doing testing. We are supporting county health, and we have the Colorado National Guard providing logistical support, and we published an interactive map of where people can get that testing near them.
What does it say to you, though, that you had to hide a shipment of tests from your own federal government?
Well, you know, we certainly value our partnership with private test providers, international, domestic, with the federal government. Whoever's willing to help us in Colorado, and I think many states feel the same, we are thrilled to partner with the federal government, with our private partners, with other nations. And, you know, Taiwan sent us 100,000 N95 masks. We're very grateful for that. So we're grateful for all the help that we can get from any source.
Are you getting the help you need from Washington?
Well, we certainly would love a greater role in helping to support testing ramping up. They're beginning to help more with some supplies. There's a new program that they're helping to provide high-quality masks to our nursing homes to help us protect the most vulnerable. Our state has also done, and we are continuing to scale up, testing of asymptomatic workers at our nursing homes to try to prevent further contagion from carriers who don't even know they have it.
What about contact tracing? NPR is reporting that Colorado needs about 1,700 contact tracers. That's 30 per 100,000 residents. How many have you hired already, and how many cases are you able to track right now?
I don't know the source for that 1,700 figure. We're certainly trying to gear up our epidemiological tracing and tracking efforts as quickly as we can. We launched a system tracker app last week. That is also being tied into both the high-touch, normal epidemiological methodology. We've doubled our number of epidemiologists, but also looking at how we can scale that in a more automated way.
Governor, like every state, you've had to make budget cuts as a result of this situation. You've made cuts to Medicaid. You say federal spending will make up for it. But what about in the long term? Will Colorado need a bailout from the federal government to keep providing vital services like health care for the poor?
Well, you know, it's a completely appropriate right now, but obviously families are tightening their belt, and it's a difficult time, and city and county and state governments are also tightening their belt. The federal government, not so much, because they just have deficit spend. We are grateful under the CARES Act for the assistance that was given to larger cities and counties in the state, and it's our understanding that Republicans and Democrats in Congress are working on the next round of aid for smaller municipalities and counties, and including some ability to help states do the response that we need for the COVID-19 crisis.
Although there's already been some pushback about giving a lot of money to states, even from the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who's talked about letting states go bankrupt.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, up to Congress. We'll obviously make do with the best of what we can. And we already cut $280 million in spending. We're certainly expecting to cut additional spending next year. It'll be substantial, probably in the billions in our state. You know, the exact amount will depend on exactly what the federal government does to help work with the states on our COVID-19 response.
Governor, you've said that visitors coming in from around the world, coming to Colorado's ski resorts, accelerated the spread of coronavirus in your state. As you look ahead, Do you think that there will be a normal ski season in Colorado next year?
Well, I sure hope we'll have as close to normal ski season as we can. And we're going to have a ski season. The word normal might not exactly characterize what it looks like. You know, frankly, we're even hoping that we have, you know, world-class mountain resorts in Colorado. Many people don't know we often have skiing into July. So we're hoping that at least some folks can get back out on the slope, some of our local residents in June, in as safe a way as possible. But in terms of what the tourism market will look like, what the the flights will look like, it's going to be tough times for the economies of our mountain resort areas. But you know what? Our world-class mountains, our rivers, our ski areas are going to be here long after any of us are gone. And we want to make sure that as soon as we're ready to welcome visitors, that we hope the visitors from across the world are ready to return and have a great time in Colorado.
Colorado Governor Jared Polis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
An art museum may never be considered an essential business in a crisis, but I don't think I'm going out on a limb in saying that art is an essential part of our lives. And sometimes artists are better than anyone at making sense of the human experience. Joining us now is Jonathan Feinberg, who's an art historian and art critic and director of the PhD in Creativity program at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks. It's always great to be with you.
Well, and at a moment like this, when we're all living through the coronavirus pandemic, how do you think art and the creative process can help us understand this moment?
Well, I would say there's two critical things we have to think about with the usefulness and importance of art. One of them has to do with integration, that is to say, bring coherence to our inner selves and who we feel we are with the world as we encounter it. So it's important for helping us understand the moment we're in and understanding the things around us. The second thing is creativity, and both of these things are very closely connected because it's a little more obvious how art promotes creativity because it really exercises the brain. It's like doing push-ups. If you want to have great abs, you got to do a lot of sit-ups. If you want to be a more creative person, you got to try it. And the creativity is important because it's the core to our adaptability. It's our ability to adapt to the new realities which we all face. And if this, we don't know very much about the future, but the one thing we definitely know is it's not going to be like things are now. And we have to be able to adapt to that or the human race will not survive.
Does it make it more difficult to tap into that creativity when artists are disconnected from everybody else and from each other?
Yes, it does make it more difficult because it's a social activity in many respects. I think there's a big problem I'm kind of worried about, and that is I feel like what's happened is that the COVID has driven everybody online. It's accelerated something that was happening anyway, but it's become much more intense. I probably get 20 emails a day from galleries trying to get me to be involved in the works that they have to sell. Because nobody can go in and look at an object anymore. Museums are trying to be relevant by getting online. And I think that there is this sense of our whole lives being pushed on into a kind of virtual space in which we no longer relate to each other in a personal sense. And if you look at what people are doing at home during this pandemic when we're all sequestered, they're making things with their hands, they're painting, they're doing drawings, they're doing a lot of cooking, there's a lot of physical activity. And I think we need to sort of bring our bodies, you know, into our experience in an important way. And the internet is, in a way, pushing us away from that. So it's a dangerous thing, I think, because it has an effect on how personality develops.
So how do artists find inspiration or motivation to create during a crisis like this?
Well, I think every artist makes the things they make because ultimately they want to see what it looks like. They want to hear what it sounds like or they want to feel it. I think the inspiration is this motivation to try and make sense out of your experience and to give yourself an opening to feel it better, to adapt to it more. It's one of the things I think is so interesting about the artist Christo. We've talked about him in the past, you and I. He does these huge public projects. And people come out in large numbers. They're confronted with something that seems unbelievable, and it suspends their disbelief about everything in the world. And all of a sudden, they have a chance to kind of readjust who they are in relation to reality. And that's the kind of paradigm I think that every artist is dealing with. They're trying to understand their own experience, so they make things to see what it will look like if I try it a different way.
Well, can you give us some examples of art created during or about a crisis or time of loss like we're living through now?
Well, it comes back to something that, again, I think is important to talk about. You know, can great work come out of moments of crisis? And, of course, there are famous examples like the Guernica by Picasso, which was a response to the bombing of this poor little town in northern Spain, which had nothing to do at all with any of the war that was going on. And the German Luftwaffe decided to try out their weapons, and they slaughtered everybody. And Picasso, who was a Spaniard, was horrified by this, and he made this painting, and they put it in the Spanish Republican Pavilion in the World's Fair, and it became a big kind of public event. A lot of important art comes about in moments of crisis. Again, another example I would think of is the moment right after the death of Mao. And, you know, in the 1980s, you had these first graduates who came out and started making sense out of their experience by painting them in a freer situation. And it was a great moment. Some of the greatest painting in the last 50 years has come out of that group of Chinese artists who emerged out of the crisis of the Cultural Revolution. So it does happen. I think that oftentimes it pushes people to work even harder, trying to make sense out of their experience because it's so dissonant, and works of art help us with that.
Now, you mentioned that galleries are having a difficult time right now because people can't actually go into the galleries and look at art. What would you say to people who are not artists, but who would like to experience some art in this moment that we're in right now? How can they do that from the comfort of their home?
Well, you know, we're all looking at movies. We're looking at, there's a lot of great TV being made. And you can go try your hand at something, you know, draw something, work with your kids, who are these great fountains of creativity. But I do think that's very hard to replace the physical experience of a work of art, because that physicality is an important part of the experience. We need that kind of immediacy. We need the sense of being personally connected to something real. So it's something to be aware of. And, you know, I think we're all finding other vehicles for that right now. It's very hard to really engage with a Rembrandt if you can't see it.
Well, and what about the museum or the gallery that would show that Rembrandt? The coronavirus has shut down those places, as well as concert halls, art fairs all over the world. Do you think this is going to have a lasting effect on these cultural institutions?
Yes, and I think they're all in a panic. Everybody's trying desperately to figure out how to deal with this online without having people there. And museums are trying so hard to have to engage you in educational events. But I'll tell you, the lasting effects are definitely going to be there, because these are all these cultural institutions are fragile, and even the business is fragile. And without the funding, and we don't have a government that seems to want to support that kind of thing, so some of the institutions will go out of business. Some have already. The small galleries especially are going to start folding. Some of these museums are going to be in desperate straits because they didn't have enough money to begin with, and now it's even worse. And I think that a lot of things will change permanently. And one of the things I think we have to be worried about, too, is that museums and works of art, these kinds of things, it's one of the few arenas left where an individual expression can exist in a kind of public scale and in a work of art. And if we lose that, we've lost one of the last vehicles for the individual to express themselves in a big way.
That is Jonathan Feinberg, who is an art historian and art critic and director of the PhD in creativity at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia. Jonathan, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for asking me.
And speaking of artists expressing themselves, Alexander Gonzalez of member station WLRN in Miami tells us about a group of college music students who got a boost of inspiration from a showbiz legend.
Toby Baysbird has been adjusting to online learning from her home in Maryland.
I sat down with my family. We kind of had to figure out schedules because, you know, there were certain classes that I needed an entire room to myself, like movement. There's something to be said about taking a dance class like in the middle of your house and while like your dogs are running upstairs.
Baysbird is studying musical theater at the University of Miami in Florida. For a little inspiration, she and her peers joked with their professor about the possibility of having a Broadway star drop into their music theory class. remotely, of course.
Can you get Barbara Streisand to, like, Zoom with us?
It's not an outrageous request. Barbara Streisand and Professor Laura Sherman go way back.
Yeah, I am her touring harpist when she takes a full orchestra.
You were my friend.
And I've been on 4 tours with her since 2006. But perhaps more importantly is my partner, Chris Carlton. He is her sound designer, and he's been working with her for the last 20 years.
Sherman says her partner overheard the students' anxiety about the changes that were happening so fast because of the pandemic. He emailed Streisand, who sent the class this audio message.
Hi, students. It's Barbara Streisand. I wanted to send you lots of encouragement in this tough, very strange time. I hope your class is going well. At least you have Zoom so you can all still learn together.
Oh, my God.
Highlight of my mom.
Oh, my God.
What the hell?
No way. Love with her.
A daily reminder to, like, get out of bed.
A daily reminder to get out of bed. That's the reaction that Professor Sherman was hoping for.
My favorite part of all of this was to see their eyes light up again. Music can enlighten us. It can take the load off. It can, you know, help elevate us.
Don't bring around a cloud to rain on my parade.
Even in Streisand's message, you know, she refers to that, you know, that music can help us get through this time.
Music is so powerful. It binds us together. It lifts us. We live in chaotic times, and music can inspire us and challenge us, as well as calm and comfort us.
Even though many theaters and concert halls remain closed, the show must go on. For Here and Now, I'm Alexander Gonzalez in Miami.
Whether I'm the rose of sheer perfection, a freckle on the nose of life's complexion, the cinder or the shiny apple of its eye.
You're listening to Here and Now. One of the items on the Senate's to-do list this week was a hearing for President Trump's nominee to be Director of National Intelligence. Republican Congressman John Ratcliffe defended himself yesterday against charges that his loyalty to President Trump will influence his actions if he gets the job. Some lawmakers are concerned the president will push him to investigate whether the coronavirus originated in a Chinese lab. Joining us now is Jane Harman, President and CEO at the Wilson Center. She's also a former Democratic Congresswoman. Jane Harman, welcome. And Ratcliffe says he'll make searching for the origins of the coronavirus a top priority. Do you think, out of loyalty to the president, he would try to prove it came from a lab in China instead of following the evidence wherever it leads?
I think it's possible. I mean, this is deja vu all over again. I was in Congress, ranking member of the House Intelligence Committee, when we saw the bad movie on Iraq. And there was conclusive proof that there were weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Obviously, the intel was false. I sadly believed it at the time and read it very carefully. But the intel was false. There were no weapons of mass destruction, and we have paid a huge price. So this is the sequel. And I understand that yesterday he also said that China is our number one threat. So I'm very dubious that the pledge given yesterday, which certainly impressed a lot of senators, is going to be the actual that he will be able to deliver if he is confirmed.
What about Ratcliffe just as a nominee for this position in general? This is the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, is a position that came out of 9/11. And the idea was to have one person who would be overseeing all the intelligence agencies and would be able to see all the intelligence that maybe they aren't sharing with each other. Do you have other concerns about his qualifications?
Yes. My concern is that his history of commenting on things is very partisan. And especially at this time, we need to actually understand Chinese intentions and capabilities. And, oh, by the way, those of North Korea, Iran, let's go around the world. We need to understand all this and make sure that policymakers get the unvarnished truth.
As the world sort of comes to a standstill during this coronavirus pandemic, what are your concerns about any issues that may be popping up around the world that in ordinary times we'd be worried about, but maybe they're going under the radar right now?
Thank you for asking that. I wrote an op-ed a couple of weeks ago saying the bad guys aren't waiting on the coronavirus to attack us. And I really think that a variety of bad actors, some of them just rogue actors and individuals, you know, garden variety terrorists in their basements, but also governments are thinking about how to continue to destabilize or even harm the United States. And I would my list of possibilities are Russia, which is still interfering in our election process and has good cyber capability. Iran, which, because we got out of the nuclear deal, is turning its centrifuges. North Korea, Kim Jong-un is back and testing medium and short range missiles, which could be topped with nuclear warheads. And certainly terror groups are reappearing in Europe, even though we are sadly at some strained relationship with the EU. It's a very important trading partner for us.
That is Jane Harman, President and CEO at the Wilson Center. Thank you so much, as always, for joining us.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Historian Jill Lepore sees herself as a detective of sorts, and a real one from the 1900s, plays a starring role in the first episode of Jill's new riveting podcast, The Last Archive, which debuts May 14th. It's the story of a murder of a young woman in Barrie, Vermont in 1919, and at times it sounds like an old radio drama from the 1930s.
Officer, there's a naked dead woman in a vacant lot near the Bustle Hotel.
Dead woman, you say?
So, who killed that young woman? It's a forensic investigation. But the case is part of Jill's exploration of a very modern question. Who killed truth? As Jill says, historians are coroners too. And this is Jill Lepore's exploration of the history of evidence, proof, and knowledge. Unsaid, we live in a time when people don't even believe a pandemic is real. Jill Lepore joins us now. And Jill, I don't know, I feel like there's going to be no keeping you down on the farm after this performance. This is thrilling.
Oh, thanks. We had so much fun making this podcast. Now I look back on anything that was fun with an especial warmth.
Right.
But yeah, it's been a really great experiment in storytelling and a new media for me. And I hope people listen in.
Well, I want to comment, you at the very beginning, when you start talking about this murder mystery in Vermont, you say something I'm glad you said, which is, how come all detective stories and all murder mysteries and all those primetime TV shows about murder always feature a beautiful young woman? It's, you know, as if they're just fodder for these mysteries. But you have a bigger goal here. Truth has been murdered. I mean, just tell us more about the backdrop of this.
Yeah. Well, in some ways, I mean, I've been teaching a class at the law school here at Harvard for the last few years called The History of Evidence. That's a kind of big history of how we know things across different realms of knowledge, beginning with the law, but also science, history, journalism. And what we kind of have come to in that class over the years together with my students is kind of this, the rise and fall of the fact is kind of the big story. Like, where did the idea of a fact as an elemental unit of evidence come from? And then in what forces have undermined that over the years and especially recently. So when I decided to work on this, to develop a podcast, it seemed like a really good question to ask because so many fun podcasts actually buy into the tropes of true crime. But they also participate in some of the same weirdnesses then of true crime, right? Like there's a kind of fetish for the fact and the clue. And we go to a trial and we're asking this question that jurors ask, you know, about guilt or innocence. But all those ways of knowing, ways of assessing what's true, those particular kinds of empiricism that move from the law to the broader culture are kind of a mess right now. So the question of the podcast tries to ask is, how did this become such a mess? Like, if we kind of take this mystery not as the story of some single crime, although each episode is a kind of single mystery like that, but blow it up into the much bigger question, kind of what happened to knowledge? Like, who killed truth?
Well, we'll pick that up again. But to this case, this first episode, this beautiful young woman, Lucinia Broadwell, who may or may not have been a prostitute. At first, the police think it might have been her husband who killed her because they knew he beat her, but eventually a boyfriend. I'm not going to go too much further into this. And your detective, James Wood, interrogates the boyfriend. He goes to trial. That's it. We're not going to say more. But what is it about this thread? And it's funny because you inform us that a clue, the word clue at one point was a thread. It was a piece of thread that you'd, knit with. And there might be threads at a murder scene, and so those would be clues, and now they are, that's the word. But why this story? What does it tell us?
Well, partly it's this story because one day when I was in the archives, in the library, I was reading through the records of the Wood Detective Agency because I just thought it was very cool. This guy, he was, his father was the first detective, private detective in all of New England. He started business in Boston in 1879, long before Sherlock Holmes, right? So the very beginnings of private detection. And the son, James Wood Jr., all of his records of his cases, his case files are in the law school library. And there was this photograph in the archives of this dead body, this naked woman, and she was bound and gagged. And it's a horrifying and distressing photograph. And it just, the fact that it was even sort of there for people to look at troubled me. It raised all these questions for me about the conventions of what is fascinating for us about the vulnerability of women, why people want to look at a woman who can no longer speak for herself. Like, there are all these I raised all these feminist hackles for me. So staring at that photograph, I set myself on a kind of quest to reinvestigate the crime, a kind of cold case. And as I was taking the steps that you would take to try to solve an old murder, I realized that those steps kind of recapitulated the whole history of how we know things. And it kind of seemed like a challenge to me. Like, is there a way to tell the story of the investigation of a single crime as opening up a kind of meta history to the history of knowledge? And then that became the kind of gambit for the whole podcast. Each episode does some version of that.
Yeah, you can look at the polio vaccine, the 1952 presidential election, the internet. But just, can you tick through some of the history of how we know things? Didn't we always just know that there was proof of something and that it was a fact?
The rules of evidence that regulate most of our systems of knowledge today are derived from the rules of evidence in the law. Like, they really do begin with the beginnings of trial by jury in the Anglo tradition, and which starts in like 1215, right? That you need corroboration, that circumstantial evidence isn't enough, hearsay is inadmissible, that you assemble a jury to evaluate the evidence, but the judge decides what evidence will be allowed in and what needs to be excluded because it's unfair or prejudice or it's just unreliable evidence. That all those rules of evidence took centuries to develop, but then they came to form the basis of what becomes really the scientific method, right? The kind of empiricism that emerges in the 17th and 18th century. All those rules then inform how we do scholarship in the social sciences, or how we think about facts in the world of journalism, like the rules that, people at NPR have when they're out reporting a story. Is my source authentic? Can I get verification? Is this hearsay? Have I stated this fairly? Those, in some ancient way, derive from the very beginnings of the rules of evidence in the law. So what's weird about our current, among the many weird things about our current moment is that how we find things out has now become automated. Like, we just do a Google search. That's, I think, part of our, like, this just epistemological crisis that we're in, that we've been in before, the beginning of this, what we call the aftertime, right? Like the time after COVID and this particular tragic moment. There really was a lot of instability and uncertainty around knowledge kind of building up.
Well, the other way we find knowledge, many people do, is from liars. You have people like Alex Jones, who put out things that are demonstrably not true. Is that what killed truth?
What I think of and talk about in the podcast is the usual suspects, right? We could, and you would look to those types of people, people who are either promoting hoaxes or declaring that things that are known to be true are hoaxes, say. But they're more like accomplices. Do you know what I mean? Like the bigger force. I sort of like want the podcast to unravel and reveal itself. But you can think about this season spends a lot of time thinking about people who tried very hard to come up with ways to decide what was true that were more modern. That would be, so for instance, I tell the story of the invention of the lie detector, or I tell a story of the attempt by Congress in 1966 to establish a national data center. There was this idea that if there was going to be all this computer manufactured data and computer stored data about people, that the government ought to have it all in one single place in the same format, which is actually a really interesting way to kind of control information and advance knowledge. But was that plan was defeated by people who were opposed to the government having that kind of authority. Of course, like we now actually have an international data center, which is everything that is owned by corporations. That's an aggregation of data about us. Yeah. Can still make it very difficult for us to know what's in those collections in a different way than would have been available to us if the government had gone ahead with that proposal.
Well, I guess what you're saying, and in much in the way that we're not going to give away the end of the murder case, we're not going to give away, the end of your exploration of truth. It just sounds fascinating. So I think we're going to have to, as you say, let it unspool. Historian Jill Lepore, host of the new podcast, The Last Archive. It's going to be available starting May 14th. There's a link to the trailer at herenow.org. Jill, just, a delight. And thank you so much for talking to us about it.
Hey, thank you so much, Robin. Take care.
Rental car companies appear to be the latest sector in the transportation industry to feel the financial pain of the coronavirus pandemic. Hertz was on the verge of bankruptcy, but has managed to avoid it for now. The company missed a lease payment last month, but it reached a deal with lenders yesterday to postpone the payment on its fleet of vehicles for a few more weeks. Here now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan joins us. And Seth, tell us more about Hertz. Why is it having a hard time making its lease payments?
Well, the business model, Jeremy, of these companies involves buying or leasing lots of cars in bulk, getting really good deals on them, and then renting them out by the day or by the week at rates where, if the cars are full most of the time, you're going to end up making a lot more money than you spend on them. The problem right now is that those leases continue as if nothing had changed, even though everything has changed. And so, Hertz had to make those payments. Now, it's, as you said, avoided having to do that partly, even though very few people are renting cars, airport lots full of rental cars from people not traveling these days.
So it wouldn't just be Hertz then. Are other rental car companies feeling the same pain?
Absolutely. Avis is one that's easy to look at because it's a publicly traded company. And it made very clear in its quarterly earnings report that it's feeling the pain too. Although Avis says that it's okay in terms of liquidity, it's not facing what Hertz is facing. Look, in any industry, most companies are being impacted the same way, at least if they're relatively similar competitors. But of course, some companies went into the crisis in better shape than others. And a company that has less debt, fewer obligations, is going to be better positioned at a time like this, even if the debt might not have mattered as much had the world not changed in the way it did.
Now, these are the traditional rental car companies we're talking about, where you rent a car, you return it, it gets cleaned, then somebody else rents it. What about the short-term rental companies like Zipcar and peer-to-peer services like Turo and Getaround?
Well, interestingly, Jeremy, Zipcar, although it's branded differently, and you might not realize this, is a unit of Avis. And we actually got to learn a little bit more about Zipcar in Avis's earnings call. And this kind of surprised me. I would think, if anything, people might be more reluctant to get into one of those cars that maybe hasn't been thoroughly cleaned since the last person used it. But sure enough, Avis said that business at Zipcar is down only 50%, only, Jeremy. This is the world we're living in, right?
Yeah.
Whereas business in general is down like 80%. And I guess if you think about it, almost nobody's flying, whereas people still have some errands that they need to run in the neighborhood and that sort of thing. And so that too is actually helping Avis, the fact that it has that Zipcar unit. Those other services, they're private, hard to say, but I'll tell you, I have a Getaround membership. That's where you basically take some stranger's car out. And I got a survey from them this week asking my thoughts on things. So reading between the lines, the thoughts about taking out a stranger's car that hasn't been cleaned and all of those things, I can only imagine what's going on there, as well as at Turo and other competitors.
Speaking of a stranger's car, Uber announced today that it is laying off about 3,700 employees. That's about 14% of its workforce. What's ahead for ride-sharing companies?
It's going to be a tough slog here for them. I mean, first of all, you have that level of comfort or not in terms of getting into a stranger's car, not being perhaps 6 feet away from them and all the rest of it. But I think the broader issue here, Jeremy, is just the fact that demand for everything is down, right? People just aren't moving around as much as before. They're not getting on public transportation. They're not driving their own cars as much as before. Now, the impact might be uneven, but that's the biggest fact of all. Once Americans start moving again, then it'll be interesting to see whether some of these sectors benefit more than others.
Meanwhile, Seth, we often talk to you about airlines, so I want to ask you about the fact that some of the major airlines are making cuts, job cuts, despite having received a portion of the $25 billion from the CARES Act. That federal bailout was contingent on not cutting pay or making layoffs. So how are they able to do this?
Yeah, interesting. Different airlines seem to be taking different views here. United is one that's been criticized for having come out here rather shortly after accepting the money and indicating that it'll make job cuts come October 1st. You know, that's the first day that airlines can do that per the package. But also, people being shifted from maybe full-time status to part-time status. There's a report by the reporter Ted Reed in Forbes that said that American internally has criticized that and saying that's not their read. Their read is that, you know, if you took this money, you couldn't change people's status like that and take money away from them. There's a popular blogger named Gary Leff who said that, you know, in his view, United might be right about the letter of the law. All this was kind of rushed through. American may be right about the intent of the law, but United's not the only one. Delta, JetBlue are others that have been criticized similarly.
You know, I just got an email yesterday from an airline saying that my flight in June has been canceled. It was the first time I've ever gotten an email like that without a thing that says, and now here's your money back, because that's not what they're doing right now. That is Seth Kaplan.
They're not making it easy. And that too varies quite a bit to a surprising degree, depending on the airline.
That's exactly right. Here Now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan, thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.